Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Simple Actions group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is BJ, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care and join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting their own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we're discussing step 4, B, and C, so fear and sex inventory. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Matt and Laura. Okay, I will read the first paragraph, which is found on page 67, and then the panel will take turns sharing for a few minutes on each on the reading. So step 4 is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So like I said, the first reading is on page 67 if you want to follow along in your big book. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We're going to start with Laura.
Hey, everybody. My name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic. So this is the beginning of the fear inventory of step 4. And I noticed that you guys don't read the next paragraph, so I'm going to actually throw that in there just because I think it's really important. But yeah, so what I learned going through my inventory and looking at every resentment I've ever had, every hurt feeling, every, self-pity feeling that I had, underneath all of those feelings for me, I discovered a fear. And it's not until I got into this part of the book with a sponsor that knew how to break it down for me that I saw how deeply this statement is true, that this short word somehow touches about every aspect of my life. It's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of my existence is shot through with it. And then the next part, This was a little hard to see at first until I started seeing the patterns in all my relationships. Fear for me has brought me misfortune that I felt I didn't deserve at first. And so, you know, some examples of that in my life are, there have been times that I have placed myself in relationships with people that I knew I should not be mixed up with for whatever reason. It could be just as simple as they didn't fit my ideal. Or people who have mistreated me, have lied to me, manipulated me, just pretty much made me feel really small in some way. And I would continue on with that person, not out of some loyalty or thing, you know, that I really had some kind of genuine feeling of love for them, but although I might think that I did, but it was because of fear. Fear that if I left or if I stopped engaging in this behavior with this person, that maybe I wouldn't find somebody else. Or maybe this is as good as it's going to get for me. So that's a fear-based decision that I've made over and over and over in my life, in sobriety and outside of sobriety, that had continuously put me in a position to be hurt. And then I would end up with a result saying, holy cow, how did I get here? You know, I don't deserve to be treated this way. Why is this person so awful to me or whatever? And I have to look at, you know, where did I set the ball rolling? I made a decision based out of fear to invite that kind of stuff into my life. Even in situations when it seems like it's been the other person's fault, I always have a part. And even if it's just as small as I was fearful, I was too afraid to say anything. So another example that we see a lot in our inventories, this was a really difficult one for me. Say you have a history of being abused as a child in some way, shape, or form. And I had a sponsor when I was looking at that, like, what is my part? And I was like, don't you dare try to tell me that I brought that on myself. And, you know, my sponsor was very loving and kind. And she's like, no, absolutely not. However, your fear might have kept, for me, my fear kept me quiet, kept me silent. And so I didn't tell the truth when I was asked what's happening to you right now. And so in that situation, my fear of telling the truth prolonged the agony of the situation that was going on at the time. So that's another instance of how fear can really just take things to a whole nother level that had I been braver, then maybe it would have gotten better a lot sooner. And the next part that we don't read about is it breaks out precisely how to do a fear inventory. It talks about, we put it on paper, we write about our fears. And so the best way I had explained to me on how to break down a fear, you know, before I had some good direction and sponsorship, I was like, oh, well, you know, let's list all your fears. I'm afraid of spiders. I'm afraid of heights. I'm, you know, all these superficial things. And that's not what this is really about. So after I go through my inventory and I see all the areas that fear is bracketed alongside my part, so say a base fear for me, or it's not really a base fear, it's a surface fear, is I'm afraid that so-and-so is going to leave me, or so-and-so is never going to talk to me again. Well, that's a surface fear. And then the part in the book says, you ask yourself, why do you have that fear? So I say, okay, well, what's so scary about that? Why am I afraid that so-and-so is going to leave me? And I get to dissect my fears. I get to review my fears thoroughly. And this is how I was taught how to do it. And so then I say, well, because if they never talk to me again, if they go away, then, you know, I'm going to be alone. I'm going to feel lonely. Okay. Well, what's so scary about that? Why are you afraid to be lonely, to feel lonely? And then I dissect it even further. And I say, well, because if I feel lonely, then I'm going to be depressed and full of anxiety. Well, why are you afraid of that? And then I keep going deeper and deeper until I get to the base fear. And all of my fears end the same way. They don't start the same way, but they end the same way. And I'll stop there.
Good evening. My name is Matt, alcoholic. Like Laura said, fear, for me, you know, I didn't think, you know, I was afraid of much, you know, coming into this thing. I thought, you know, fear of spiders, heights, going bald, that's about it, you know. But when I take this inventory and I take an honest look at it, a lot of the, you know, the decisions that I've made and the people that I've hurt have been based out of fear, you know. Fear of dying alone, fear of not being accepted, things like that. And it wasn't until, you know, I sat down with a sponsor and broke it down that I start to see these things. A lot of it, I really like where it talks about, you know, it's, we think fear ought to be classified with stealing. A lot, you know, a lot of my behaviors that were based out of fear, it was like I was stealing. I was lying to people. I was stealing emotion from them, time, things like that. You know, for what? For selfish reasons. I mean, what it all boils down to is my selfishness and my self-centeredness, and that always causes, you know, a problem when I act in self. It normally doesn't turn out well. I could probably count on one hand how many times it has, and I still have a couple fingers left. Let's see. The short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives, though. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. You know, I always characterized fear as younger when I was younger as just being a worrywart, as my mom would say. You know, I was always worried about, you know, the littlest of things, like, and had all this anxiety that I couldn't explain. I mean, I guess now, today, I can look back on it and, you know, it's fear. Yeah, that's all I got. Thanks for me sharing.
Thank you.
Next reading is on page 68. Perhaps there is a better way, we think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him. Does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear.
This is a pretty cool part because it gives me some hope. One of my favorite promises in this book is the sentence, just to the extent that I do as I think He would have me and humbly rely on Him, does He enable me to match calamity with serenity? And calamity, I looked up the definition, is an event causing great and often sudden damage or distress. And I don't know if you guys know what that feels like, but, I do. And I can attest that this is the truth. Sometimes stuff happens. I think that had I not gone through this process of going through the steps and gotten to a place where I really believe in the power of God, that there's probably absolutely no way I would have survived some things that have happened in my life in sobriety. So when calamity comes, and you know, it might not come, you know, as harsh as it has for some of us, but there's light at the end of the tunnel. And sometimes, you know, when I meet other people who are going through a really dark time in their sobriety or wherever they are in their life, it's hard to convince somebody just with your words and say, hey, it's going to get better. Just hang on. Just keep coming back. You know, these frothy things that we say. But when I meet somebody who has gone through something equally as hard as the thing that I'm going through, and they tell me precisely what they did to overcome it, and they didn't drink again, and they didn't self-destruct, and then I can see, you know, I witness somebody in front of me that is okay. They have survived, and they have serenity. They have some kind of peace and acceptance over the things that have happened to them in their life. I need those examples. And I need people to have the courage to talk about the really hard things that happen. You know, I don't get to shut the door on my past. I don't. Sometimes I want to. But when I'm willing to have the courage to talk about really hard things that have happened to me, it gives light to other people. And so sometimes when it gets really hard and all I want to do is either, you know, cry or get mad at God and say, why me? Why does stuff like this keep happening to me? All I have to do is just keep putting one foot in front of the other and just do what it says to do. Show up. For me, showing up to Alcoholics Anonymous, in spite of how I have felt, has been half the battle. Telling the truth is the other half. And when I have done that, I have been able to face my problems and my difficulties with some semblance of grace and come out on the other side and be okay. And that's pretty incredible, because I don't know about you guys, but when I got here, I definitely had my list of reserves. Like, if this ever happens or if this ever happens, I don't know if there's any way I can stay sober. Like, I don't know if I can get through that. And be careful what you say, because I had a lot of stuff thrown at me, and I've been able to survive all of it. And the next part, you know, allowing God to demonstrate through me what he can do. So that's part of the third step prayer or contract that I did with God when I say, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self so I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. Right there, I'm asking God for help. I'm asking you to take away my problems. But in exchange is so that when I overcome my problems, that I can bear witness to those that I'm going to help. And so in that sense, God is making good use of the pain that I've been through. And then there's a very specific prayer that it gives us when fear crops up, and it's so simple. I ask God to remove my fear and direct my attention to what he would have me be. And that's difficult for somebody like me, because I'm a fixer and I'm a doer, and I want to get in there and figure out a way to change the circumstances in my life so that I can feel better. And this is disciplining me to not do anything, to just ask for the help and be still. And that's really hard, especially when you're hurting and you're full of fear and you're having panic attacks. But if I can start practicing this behavior and this prayer, it says, I will commence to outgrow fear. Now, it doesn't say that I'll never experience fear again, but when it crops up, that I can find a better way to deal with it. And the better way of dealing with it is inviting God into my life, asking him for help with that problem. That's all I have.
Thank So this first sentence, what it really makes me think about is that, you know, either God is everything or He is nothing. You know, that's something that I have to remind myself on a regular basis. You know, I like to take the wheel. You know, run on self-will, try and do things the way that I want. And when I'm doing that, God's definitely nothing in my life. You know, and it's very evident. But when I am putting my trust in God, and you know, reminding myself that He is everything, I will keep my faith in Him. It always turns out better than I could have imagined that it would. It's not the way that I might have liked for it to be, or that I would have wanted it to be, but it's always far better than if I try to stick my hand in it and manipulate it in any kind of way. We are in the world playing the role. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that He would, that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely upon Him. The role that He has for me today is a lot different than, you know, I thought it would be when I first came in here. You know, I always wanted to be able to help people when I was younger. That's what, you know, I would tell my mom. My mother's a guidance counselor, so I guess that kind of rubbed off on me in some sort of way. And you know, I never realized, you know, like, that this is what, you know, God's purpose is for me, is to help out other alcoholics. And you know, when I first came in here, I couldn't even help myself to anything except another drink. And you know, I was I fought it tooth and nail every step of the way until I got in enough pain that, you know, I was ready to turn my will and my life over to God. And you know, His purpose for me today is to help His children. And you know, that's a very very cool thing. You know, I think the best gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is watching the people that I sponsor's lives get, you know, way better than it was when I first met them. And it's not because of anything special that I've done. It's just what, you know, the program has taught me to do. And yeah, that's an amazing thing. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. I can remember, you know, hearing people say that, you know, oh, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And I used to think that was the dumbest thing ever. It made no sense to me. I guess I get what they're talking about now, you know. I don't go to church every Sunday. I would say I have a better relationship with my Creator than quite a few people who, you know, who are in church every Sunday, because I'm in constant contact with Him. You know, I don't have a choice in this thing anymore. You know, when I'm not, watch out. You know, it's gonna get scary, and it's gonna get a little crazy pretty quickly. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. That's something that, you know, I have to remind myself all the time. You know, that I'm, you know, I am a member of this fellowship, and there are people that are not, that know this. And you know, I might be the only face you know, of AA that these people ever see. And, you know, am I on my good church behavior, or am I acting, you know, like an alcoholic, you know? And that's something, you know, that I have to remind myself of quite often. You know, my first gut reaction is to get angry, you know, because it's easier for me to get angry than to think about why I'm fearful or scared. You know, fear's just a much easier emotion for me to deal with, or anger's a much easier emotion for me to deal with. I'll pass on that.
Thank you all. Third reading is on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Laura.
My favorite topic. So it talks to us about sex and romantic relationships in our literature. It wants me to put it down on paper, put it in writing. Separate from my resentments. And I'm thank God they're saying that we all have problems here, so I don't have to feel like there's something wrong with me if I'm struggling in this area of my life. And there's some warnings. It says that here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes. And I've heard some interesting advice from people in Alcoholics Anonymous about what I should and shouldn't be doing. And luckily, I know what the book says. And so perhaps what you say might make sense for me, and I might, you know, perk my ears up, and if it sounds right or feels right, I might try to apply that in my situation. But when in doubt, I go to the book. I have had people, I've heard people say, you know, just stay away from relationships altogether, no relationships for the first year in sobriety. I've heard people say, if you're having trouble with commitment, to just abstain altogether, so be celibate. I've heard people say, don't date so-and-so, don't date this group of people. I've heard all kinds of wacky advice and suggestions, and you know, and I've tried it all too. I've tried abstaining. I've tried all kind, you know, not dating this group of people, doing this instead, and what I've come to find in my own personal life is that God's in charge of this area of my life. I think people mean well when we advise each other in this area, and I've definitely been guilty of trying to talk to my girls that I meet about this subject, and just all I know is when you tell them not to do something, they're going to do it anyway. So it warns us that we should stay out of this controversy, and that I should not be an arbiter. And that means not just an arbiter of other people's personal relationships and what they decide to do, but also an arbiter of my own. I have been probably the harshest critic and judge about my own personal relationships and things that I have done and not done. And And I don't want to do that. I want to stay out of that controversy. And that's really, I mean, the next thing is, what can we do about them? And we haven't read that part yet, so I'm going to stop there.
Many of us have needed an overhauling on our sex life. I would say that that's definitely the case. You know, when I came in here, you know, my sex ideal was, you know, no, I do not want to have sex with you unless it's with me, in which case, yes, I would love to. I mean, I'll be honest, you know. And I can, you know, I can look at that now, and, you know, like, I've heard a lot of people out of my own selfish wants and needs, and I don't know, it's weird, like, I don't have any sisters or anything like that, but that was brought to my attention, you know, that these are people's daughters, and these are people's sisters, and that kind of thing. And when you break it down like that, it makes it a little harder to, you know, to lie and manipulate and, you know, use these women just for my own selfish wants and needs. I think it goes back to, you know, what is it that God has, you know, in store for me? Like, am I doing what I want just for this period of time to try and make myself feel better for some ease and comfort? Or, you know, am I praying about this? Am I putting this person's, you know, happiness before my own? You know, when that kind of stuff is going on, it's usually because I'm praying about it. I'm trying to do what it is that I feel God, you know, God would have me to do, and put the right person in front of me. You know, is that going to happen? I don't know. You know, hopefully, maybe one day. I don't know. I think my biggest fear, when I took my inventory, was dying alone, you know, like, and today, like, I'm okay with that, you know. I've got God in my heart, you know. I've got a cat, like, what else do you need, you know. Yeah, I think that's all I got.
Thank you. The fourth reading is on page 69. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for a future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed.
Good stuff. So, some very specific things I'm supposed to be asking myself anytime I am either pondering getting involved with somebody or already involved with somebody. And then, of course, looking, when you're doing it for the first time, looking at relationships from the past, these are the inventory questions. Was I selfish? Was I dishonest? Was I inconsiderate? Did I hurt somebody? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? Yeah, lots of it. And so this is really important for me too when I'm checking my motives. I don't hear that talked about a lot in the meetings anymore, but checking my motives. So when I'm trying to figure out whether or not this particular relationship in my life is God's will or my will, it's helpful to look at these questions. And so, and discuss it with another person, because sometimes I think I'm not being dishonest, and I think that I haven't, that they're hurting me, I'm not hurting them. And if you got a really smart sponsor, they might be able to shift your perspective a little bit and help you to see where you're wrong, and perhaps you are causing some harm that you're not aware of. And so some examples of that for me have been, and it kind of leads into the next paragraph when we look at what our ideal is, being in a situation where both parties have said that this is not my ideal, the situation, but we keep engaging in the behavior. And so we're like, well, we told the truth. We said that this isn't really what we normally do and what, you know, is not my ideal, but we continue to engage in the behavior. I'm like, well, that person keeps coming to me, so that's not my fault, you know. And my sponsor told me that I am causing that person harm because they specifically told me that XYZ is not my sexual relationship ideal, and I am enabling them to continue in that behavior. And I was like, what? How am I at fault for that? But I am. It takes two people. And so when I look at that kind of stuff and I'm enabling somebody else's bad behavior that they have personally expressed to me that this is not what they want for themselves, and I'm like, well, if they don't care, I don't care. That's selfish. And it's dishonest. When I start acting out of my relationship ideal, I'm being dishonest with myself. This is one thing I used to do a lot. When I get my feelings hurt, and then I go prancing into the room with some other guy on my shoulder, trying to cause some bitterness and suspicion, trying to get elicit a reaction. When I'm hurt because somebody I really wanted to be with rejected me, and then I go and fall into the arms of somebody else that's giving me attention. Selfish, dishonest, thinking that somebody's not going to get hurt when I'm using people for ease and comfort. These are things that I think are really important to talk about and get honest about, because I don't know about anybody else in here, but the two things in my life that have driven me closer to a drink than anything else is resentment and sexual relationships going bad. And so I have to be able to talk about this stuff. I have to be able to inventory my behavior and look at my motives and look at how my actions are affecting other people and affecting my sobriety. Because if I don't, then on the next page it tells me that I might get drunk again. And I have. I got drunk again after 5 years because of a relationship going bad. And not taking my inventory and not answering these questions and not being honest and not being willing to invite God into my life and help me in that area. So I drank again. The next part, when it talks about a sex ideal, I had a sponsor before I got a big book sponsor. We didn't even talk about this. I didn't even know what my ideal was when I came here. I knew that I wanted a really good-looking guy that was taller than me. And that was about it. When I got my first big book sponsor and we went through this part, she had me write about what my ideal was. And it wasn't about how tall he was or how good looking he was. It was about principles and characteristics. You know, do we have shared values? You know, is he humble? Does he believe in God? Like, these kind of things started becoming really important to me when I got sober. Are we compatible? you know, not just physically. I never really thought about this stuff before. I just reacted. I saw somebody, he was hot, and I was like, I'm there, let's do it. You know, but this is asking me to really consider, what do I want? And what is good for me? And just because I want something doesn't mean it's good for me. It says I invite God into this area of my life, that I ask God to mold my ideals and help me live up to them. And then it tells me that I don't have to feel guilty about sex. It says that my sex powers, I love that, sex powers, that I have them, and that it's okay that I have them, but it tells me that it's God-given, and they shouldn't be. I shouldn't use my sex powers to manipulate or to punish. And I shouldn't feel guilty. It's not, you know, it's not to be despised and loathed. And I love that, that that's there, because I definitely have come with my fair share of guilt and shame about the past, and it's saying that I don't have to feel that way anymore. But for me, I have to be willing to let God take me to better things. So if I'm engaging in behaviors that are causing me to wake up the next day feeling remorseful, then I need to look at that. And this gives me some very concrete instructions on how to do that. Thanks.
So I guess for me, the ideals, what I have as far as what I look for in a partner and a mate today are a lot different than they were, you know, at 1 year sober. You know, like a lot of the things that Laura just, you know, mentioned are, except for the really tall and handsome, like I'll pass on that. But you know, like are we compatible? You know, does she believe in, you know, does she believe in God? What are her family values like? Things like that. I could have cared less, you know, about that kind of stuff before, you know, actually sitting down and taking a look at all this and actually thinking about, you know, what it is, you know, that I want out of a partner. And I think that's, you know, one of those things that's growing and changing the longer that I stay in this fellowship, because I'm changing and growing. You know, the values that I have today are different than they were last year, and I'm sure they'll be different next year. You know, I'm still kind of figuring this out. I guess this is just, you know, a part of me growing up, if you will. I've definitely caused quite a bit of jealousy and suspicion and things like that. One of the things that I like to do a lot was, you know, when I was upset or down, was to try and belittle and, you know, make them feel less than, to try and, you know, make myself feel better about me, or, you know, to get them as miserable as I am at that moment in time. I'm definitely guilty of that. That's something that I still do from time to time. I'm not proud of it. It's just one of the things that, you know, I do. Yeah, I think that's all I got.
Thank you. Our fifth reading is also on page 69. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situations. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
So after I've written down my ideal and I have a goal, then anytime I'm either reviewing my current relationship that I'm involved in, or if I'm considering something new, I have to remind myself, what do I want? What did I say that I want? What I wanted. And then I have to be willing to make some decisions to help me get closer to that, not further away. And it tells me that I'm supposed to meditate about these things. So there's been a lot of times where it wasn't exactly clear to me whether this is right or wrong. And sometimes I think there's a lot of shades of gray. But if I am taking it into prayer and meditation and I get quiet and I do it for long enough and I'm asking God, please show me the truth about this situation, this relationship, this person, that eventually the answer is going to come. And it might not be what I want it to be. I think that the longer that I've been sober and the longer that I practice these things, my intuition is getting stronger and stronger. So much so that when I'm involved in a situation and I'm going against the grain because I'm being selfish and I just want to feel good, so I'm doing it anyway, I've had panic attacks because I am going opposite of my ideal. And so when I stopped the behavior, my symptoms went away. If I get quiet and I'm looking at my part in a situation and I'm looking at my ideal, sometimes it's pretty clear whether or not I should continue on in that situation or not. Sometimes I'm not ready to let go. I'm a fighter, and I will, I'll hang on till the bitter end sometimes. But sometimes that's really dangerous. And my story can definitely attest to that being the truth as well. God alone can judge my sex situation. Thank God I don't have to go to you guys and have you tell me whether or not what I'm doing is right and wrong. That's between me and God. And I know we didn't read the next part, but I'm going to talk about it anyway because it's important too. It talks about when we fall short. So I am not perfect. And even though I have a very clear ideal, I have gone outside of that ideal and I've engaged in selfish, dishonest behaviors in sobriety. And it's got a really strong warning about this. It says that if my conduct continues to harm other people, that we are quite sure to drink. And that happened to me. But it says, if I am sorry for what I have done and I have the honest desire to let God take me to better things, then we believe we'll be forgiven and we have learned our lesson. So that means that when I fall short, I have to get honest about it, I have to answer the inventory questions about it, I have to ask God for help with it, and consciously make decisions to help me get further to my ideal, not further away from it. But if I continue to make decisions based on selfish fear, because I'm afraid to be alone, because I don't want to go through the withdrawals that I have when I'm no longer with somebody that I have been with. And I continue to take myself back to away from my ideal, it's telling me I'm going to get drunk. So that decision is mine. I think that we don't talk about this enough. And it's incredibly important because my sobriety is on the line. You know, if I didn't have a sponsor that I couldn't talk to about this stuff, I'd be absolutely screwed. Solitary self-appraisal is not enough for me in this area of my life because it's just such a huge part of my life. So I'm so grateful that I can be open and honest and have in-depth conversations about this area of my life. And I'm glad that I have sponsorship that guides me to what it says in the book about this area of my life. With that, I'll pass.
So I'm looking at this where it says we are to make amends where we have done harm, and that's all I see. You know, when I'm reading this without a sponsor, you know, the first time I don't see the rest of that sentence, and so like in my sick and twisted thinking, I think, oh great, this is the perfect excuse for me to try and go and you know, right some of these wrongs that I've done and maybe, you know, have it work out in my favor, you know. And thankfully, you know, I did sit down and read this with the sponsor, and, you know, I did take an inventory, and, you know, it was the same thing, you know, stay the hell away from them, you know, that kind of thing. And rightfully so. You know, the idea of having God, you know, direct me towards what my ideal is it's kind of a comforting thing, you know. It's kind of I get to just sit back and relax, and, you know, when I'm ready, you know, It'll be put in front of me, you know. I don't have to worry about this kind of stuff anymore, which was, you know, that was something I worried about a lot, you know, being younger, like, you know, am I ever going to get married? Am I ever going to find that right one? You know, like, I'm a guy, I don't want to admit this kind of stuff, you know, but like realistically, yeah, you know, these are things that I think about. But you know, just knowing that it's one of those things that it's out of my hands. Like, as long as I'm trying to grow towards my ideal, I believe that it'll be put in front of me. And once again, I'm sure it'll not be what I expected or what I thought it would look like, but I'm pretty sure it's probably going to be a lot better than if I were to just do it myself, you know. Yeah, that's all I got.
Thank you. We just have a couple minutes left, so I'll read the last paragraph and just let you guys wrap up about a minute. Page 70. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision in an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
Okay, so it should say when sex is very troublesome, not if. We throw ourselves the harder into helping others. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. I cannot tell you how much this advice is just dead on. When I have been in the ringer with a relationship, my tendency is I want to throw myself deeper into the relationship and trying to solve the problem. Anytime I do that, I make it far, far worse. So this tells me when I'm struggling in this area, and the struggle could just be just that I'm single and I have no prospects. Or it could be as I'm having, you know, lots of arguments with the person that I'm with, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But this is telling me, don't focus on the relationship. Find a drunk to work with. And it never fails. When I'm trying to work with other women in Alcoholics Anonymous, usually they have the same type of problems I do. And it does quiet the urge. Relationships, it's hard, especially when you're trying to end a relationship and move on and let go. It's hard not to just latch on to something else for ease and comfort. But this, doing this instead, has been life-changing for me. It gives me the time that I need to grow and heal and not just put a Band-Aid on it and really take a look at, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing here. And when I do that, when I focus on working with others, I get better and I get stronger. And so it's easier to make better decisions the next time around and get closer to what I really want for myself. With that, I'll pass.
I think, I think this sums it up pretty well. You know, whenever you're having problems, you know, whether of lack of sex or the whatever, you know, wrong kind, any aspect of my life, you know, when I find another alcoholic to work with, everything is, you know, forgotten about for that short period of time. It tells me that, you know, in the beginning of chapter 7, that nothing will so much as ensure immunity from alcohol as intensive work with other alcoholics. And it uses the word impunity. To my knowledge, that's the only place in the big book that says that. And that's a pretty bold statement. And that's why I try to, you know, stay in constant contact with newcomers and things of that sort, so that I'm not so caught up in self. Because that's one of my favorite things to do. I think that's all I got. Thanks for sharing.
Thank y'all so much for sharing. We have a handful of Alrighty, I will now pass the Seventh Tradition Basket. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. At this time, are there any AA-related announcements? Kyle.
Hi, my name is Kyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Kyle! Yeah.
November 12th is the Virginia bid for the Southeastern Regional Conference of Young People in AA. It's our business meeting. It's going to be out in Charlottesville. There's a good number of people from this area going. If you would like to be a part of that bid, please let me know, and we can carpool together out there. If you'd like to know some more information about that, again, it's going to be November 12th out in Charlottesville at 5 p.m. Please talk to me at the meeting if you're interested. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Tony? Thank you. Anybody else? Jen?
Next fall is having its
first anniversary. It's going to be a potluck dinner, late night snacks at 9, and then speaker going to be David at 10 on November 14th at the BBRC down at the Ocean Front.
Awesome. Thank you. Anybody else? All right. I have one. Simple Actions. This home group is having supper and a speaker Monday, December 26th. It's going to be a potluck supper starting at 6 p.m., speaker at 7. Alrighty. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. Alrighty. There is literature available. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you'd like to purchase a book. If you can fold it, it is free. Sponsorship is NAA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me and ask me any questions you have about sponsorship. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, which is simpleactions.net, and that URL is also on the literature table. In closing, I want to thank our panel again if you get my help. Alrighty, and thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on step 4 at the meeting after the meeting, which is held at Plaza del Sol on Colonial and 22nd. Could I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164?
Leanne?
Thank you.
My name is Leanne. I'm an alcoholic.
Leanne.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. All those who care to join me in closing with the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you so much.